What's your name?
Charlie Williams.
Senator Groner?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, we have amendments prepared here. I might say first that I met with the people, with the privately owned ambulances as well as the fire departments about a week ago last Saturday, and we came to this agreement and we have met since in my office, and I think maybe you were there at one meeting or we discussed
it. No, I was not.
Well, the amendments that you have, I don't know what happened. I had their attorney meet with legislative council and had it all set up. They were supposed to have amendments here.
Is it Mr. Milbank?
Is it Mr. Milbank?
Yes, sir.
Is he here?
Yes, he's right on your right.
Anyhow, I can't understand why the amendments weren't prepared, which were to put the administration under the Department of Health and require certificates of necessity of anyone that wanted to go in the ambulance business, a hearing similar to the public utilities as a public
Senator
utilities.
Senator Groner, I know you are not a member of this committee, so you don't know what went on. We've had hearings on this, and we received from the private ambulances, I'm not speaking about Mr. Milbank's testimony, but other than that, it's a completely negative letters on this, don't amend, and they had notice of these hearings, nobody testified, nobody came in, and then I asked Mr. Milbank specifically, the day before this bill was going out, if they had anything more they wanted to say so we could invite them in, and he indicated they did not, and then this bill went to the floor, and it was brought back as a courtesy to you,
and
in spite of the expense and everything of doing this, caused by the private ambulance company, they brought back here, and so we're back here now considering this amendment that should have been taken into consideration or three hearings we had on this bill.
Mr. Chairman, might I say that I'm disappointed because I set up a meeting in my office. We had someone from legislative council there. They agreed. We got the legislative council, Mr. Milbank together, and members of that were interested, the private as well as the public sector that operate these ambulances. They were supposed to sit down and come up with proper amendments. And I'm not there to write the amendments. We thought it was all taken care of, and I get these amendments here, and it's just not accomplishment, and I'm disappointed in them. I don't know what to what avail. I guess it's up to them, you know, if they want to, but I can't see them. Maybe Mr. Milbank wants to explain what happened. I don't know.
Thank you, Senator. Is there anybody else to testify on Senate Bill 42?
We got a sign-up sheet here.
I want to tell you, Mr. McClure, the clerk of committee, is in the hospital. London flu. He's hospitalized on Sunday.
You get your name and address.
He fed intravenous Leonard or your name.
That's rushing up. That's
all we have. Sure. We all have 10 days. State your name and address and who you represent.
Bill Leonard, a commercial ambulance operator from Eugene, Oregon. Mr. Senator and members of the committee, this Senate Bill 42, I concur with what Senator Groner said. There was some miscommunication between our legal counsel and the counsel of the representing the legislature. We do feel that this thing has to be corrected on behalf of the rural fire districts, also has to be corrected on behalf of the commercial ambulance operators throughout the state. I apologize on behalf of the Oregon State Ambulance Association that we were not here and we did not have our house in order to get our testimony before you sooner. But there has been efforts put on the volunteer, the rural fire districts, the fire chiefs, and the commercial operators. We think we have everything together now. What has to be done? And I would ask your ask if we could have one more crack to get the proper amendments to you.
Excuse me just a second. Mr. Hunsinger, would you go over there in the center gallery and get a page up here?
There's one on the way.
Okay, thank you. Excuse me.
All I said was that the rural fire districts, the commercial ambulance operators, and the fire chiefs have met, and we have agreed upon how this has to be straightened out. Well, I apologize that our legal counsel and ourselves, we did not get the proper amendments to you this morning here, but due to communications with the mails, we did not receive them until late.
Well, this amendment here has the Oregon State Bar number 136 on it, which is dated February 6th. Is that the amendment that you're suggesting?
The amendment that that you have now before you is an amendment that we do not concur with.
You don't concur with
it? No. It's partially, it's partially right, but there is...
Well, what is the amendment that you're getting?
Well, just like Senator Groner stated, that we feel that there should be a need necessity so that any type of ambulance that is going into the ambulance business in the state of Oregon, that there are certain guarantees that they are properly trained, they have proper equipment in their ambulances.
So there's no written amendment here today that you're suggesting, right?
That is correct.
Okay.
I'll be happy to answer any questions on behalf of commercial operators if there's any questions.
I don't know. Senator Meeker.
Mr. Chairman, I'd comment on the amendments.
Well, I've got, if you've got something I don't have, I've got here Oregon State Bar 136.
Yes, sir.
And this witness said he didn't know anything about that.
I would like to point out, Mr. Chairman, these amendments were placed on my desk in my office, and I turned them over to your committee clerk. And I would point out that the Oregon State Bar conducting these amendments put into the amendment the old House Bill 12.7, which doesn't even exist.
You don't know where they came from?
I have no idea where they came from.
I believe he's referring to House Bill 2257. That's the wrong...
Is that the one that sets up the standards?
That is correct.
Okay. Any other questions?
Thank you very much.
Any other witnesses?
Morning. My name is
back.
Walter Flatt, Fire Chief, and I represent the Oregon Fire Services. I am in opposition to these amendments as proposed.
Now, which ones are you talking about?
As presented here now.
Okay. On the certificate of need?
On the requirements of enrolled House Bill 1227, or which is House Bill 2257 now. We like the bill. The way it came out of committee before, we saw a lot of merit in the vote of the people. We would like to maintain that status. Number two, we can't see rural fire protection districts being tied to proposed amendments, which nobody else at this point is. And we have no idea what these amendments will be at this point. Therefore, we have no choice but to oppose these amendments as presented and urge that the bill be returned in its original form as left this committee last Thursday.
Senator Jernstein,
are we considering these amendments?
Not at this point, we aren't. We're considering a suggestion that the bill be amended for a certificate of need before anybody goes in the ambulance business. But I understand the suggestion is.
Well, I would like to see the writing before I start looking.
The best we can do, Senator.
Come in with an oral request.
Senator Meeker.
Chairman, the previous witness testified there was unity on this amendment. The rural fire district opposed the certificate of need idea?
No, sir, we're not opposed. We would hope that we would have permissive legislation to provide ambulance service by vote of the people, and we're willing to be picked up in House Bill 2257. The same as everybody else is, commercial, volunteer, and fire departments. And we feel this is the place to pick everybody up and give us permission legislation that we need.
What you're saying is, Mr. Chairman, what you're saying is Senate Bill 42 is a separate subject.
Yes, it is. It covers only rural fire protection districts. It covers nobody else. And we would support standards and certificates in a separate measure or separate legislation. And we would hope to be picked up on that the way everybody else would. We do like the vote of the people concept that came out of this committee. We see a lot of merit in it. And we'd like to hold on to that if we can.
Any other questions? Is there anybody in the audience who knows where these amendments, OSB 136, came from?
I believe Oregon State Bar Council, I'm Chad Novak here, but the Oregon State Bar Council and myself were working on the draft, and we started to work on this thing, and it got out of hand. It got printed before we got our final word done on the bill, and we all were sort of asleep at the switch, and by the time it got circulated, it was too late to get it back. There is an error, it shouldn't be 1227, it should be 2257, quite obviously. And our idea was that...
I just wanted to find out where it came from, then we'll go to the merits of it. Anybody have any other questions? Thank you. Are there any other witnesses on SB 42?
Senator, my name is Spike Durfee. I'm president of the Oregon Volunteer Ambulance Association.
What's your address?
Redmond, Oregon.
Senator, are you at Redmond, Oregon? Would that reach you? Do we have to have a full...
Send it to Redmond Fire Department, Redmond, Oregon.
Thank you.
I'm here because we feel that things are a mite confused concerning House Bill 42. I concur with Walt Platt in the fact that I don't think we should clutter up our rural fire district law with a considerable amount of rules and regulations for ambulances. My people feel that if we would like to see 2257 pass, then that would give the foundation for future legislation concerning ambulances. So the net result is we got the cart before the horse with Senate Bill 42. Hopefully, and I'm unaware of how this bill came out of committee originally, but hopefully we would take the ambulance legislation and implications out of 42, and possibly a whole new bill needs drafting to solve the problems that have arisen in Senate Bill 42. So my people would agree to drop the italicized area out of House Bill 42, which is, I think, the original concept of why it's here. And then if we need some more ambulance legislation, let's draft an ambulance bit of legislation covering all people, not just rural fire districts or anything else. Because if you're going to legislate for ambulances, no use being selective and only applying these laws to one small segment of the people that are involved in ambulance service. Because if, say, a fire department couldn't adhere, a rural fire district couldn't adhere to this legislation under a rural fire district, they would just band under another hat and form an ambulance service under the auspices of the Lions Club or the Hospital Auxiliary or what have you. So it seems to me that we're not really going to solve the problem for Oregon if we legislate 42 as it exists. I think it should be a bill of its own. But I'm sure that the volunteer ambulance people will agree to anything that's reasonable, that people are treated equally. And I do like the idea of a area being able to vote on an issue, because that also inadvertently means they will financially respond to the need. Thank you.
Any questions? Anybody else here to testify on Senate Bill 42? I would like to advise the committee that the Greens have been very active, but we have 30 letters and telegrams, and some support of the Senate Bill 42 as it went to the floor. Most of them are from local ranges, but many of them are also from individuals. Any other testimony on Senate Bill 42? What's the committee's desire?
Mr. Chairman, I think that the witnesses that spoke to us today clearly identified Senate Bill 42 amends the rural fire district law, and the amendments that your committee put on this bill to take care of the problem in protecting the private ambulance service. They refer to the Rural House Bill 2267, which indeed would take care of the other problems they're talking about in a different section. For those reasons, Mr. Chairman, I move amended Senate Bill 42 before we do that.
Okay. Any discussion? Call the roll.
Senator Sternstedt?
Yes.
Senator Howell?
Yes.
Mr. Cook?
Meeker?
Aye.
Mr. Chairman?
Aye.
Excuse Cook, Burns, John, and Carson.
Goodbye. Motion is carried. Senate Bill 42 in the present form to go to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Now we'll take up Senate Bill 159. Did you have a pass?
Yeah.
Mr. Straw?
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, my name is John Strong. I'm a professor of law at the University of Oregon School of Law in Eugene. I am appearing only as an interested citizen, and I am asked to make specific that I do not represent in my views the University of Oregon or the State Board of Higher Education. I'm appearing in favor of Senate Bill 159, the Uniform Residential Landlord-Tenant Act, and I would strongly urge the committee to act favorably on this bill. I'm informed that on a previous occasion, the committee has already heard from another academic of my variety, and I therefore am not going to retread the same ground concerning the feudal origins of the present landlord-tenant law and the inappropriateness of that law to present-day conditions, particularly in the urban landlord-tenant area. I do not intend to discuss the specific provisions of the bill. I would be glad if any member of the committee has a question that they would like to direct to me to try to give my views as to specific provisions. I would just briefly like to make two points, essentially going to the same point. I would urge that if the committee is disposed to act favorably on this bill, that it should be sent forward in its present form. I say that for basically two reasons. The first is that this bill is the product of long and careful examination by several agencies, commissioners on uniform state laws, who have available the talents of highly skillful draftsmen, not draftsmen. They worked very hard on this. I think the product, though I would not certainly go so far as to say that my personal choice on every particular provision would be the same as that of the commissioners. Nevertheless, the bill does form an integrated whole. The provisions, I think, are intended and are calculated to work together in a way such as to attempt a fair and equitable treatment in an area where there is an obvious, very obvious clash of economic interests. The other point, which would support the same contention, that is that I would hope that amendment of the bill is kept to a minimum or non-existent. The second point is that I think there is a collateral advantage to the judiciary and the legal profession in the enactment of proposed uniform laws in their proposed form, and that is that it thereby generates the ability to use the decisions of other states on exactly the same law, the same statutory provision. This in turn, not only is that of great help to the courts themselves, but it also lends a greater amount of certainty to persons operating under the law and to attorneys advising those persons, because of course there is a greater pool of authority construing exactly the same provision. I would note in conclusion that there is a significance stemming from the fact that the commissioners have designated this as a uniform act, not a model act, the distinction there being that the term uniform is intended to designate those laws which the commissioners feel it is necessary or desirable in order to obtain maximum benefit from the law to enact in essentially the same form in all enacting states. This particular law, my most recent information is that this Uniform Act has already been introduced in at least six legislatures, and I believe there is a substantial benefit to be derived from its enactment in its present form. Thank you.
Are there any questions of Dr. Jones? Thank you. Appreciate you coming and your written comments.
Mr. McCabe.
And Mr. Martin.
Mr. Chairman, it's my pleasure to introduce Mr. John McCabe from Chicago, Illinois, who is the legislative director of the National Conference of Commissioners on Uniform State Laws, which offers technical assistance to the legislature in connection with this consideration of this bill. Mr. McCabe.
Thank you, Jim. I am legislative director for the National Conference of Commissioners on Uniform State Laws. My name is John McCabe.
What is your address?
1155 East 60th Street, Chicago. As legislative director, I act for the conference in all of the states of the United States to bring the Uniform Acts to the state legislatures for their consideration. I should say that although my residence is currently in Chicago, I am a Westerner by birth and by inclination, and it pleases me very much to appear today here in Oregon, especially on a beautiful day like today. The Uniform Residential Landlord...
We're all that way in Oregon.
Pardon?
All of our needs that way in Oregon.
I'll take your word for it, Senator. It certainly is better than Chicago. Chicago, at this point in time, is in the throes of a cold wave. The Uniform Residential Landlord and Tenant Act is one of the important promulgations by the conference in its last annual meeting in August of 1972. It is, we feel, one of those acts which is pointed particularly at some rather substantial imbalances in the law around the United States today. The fact that it is pointed towards some substantial imbalances is evidenced by the number of states which are currently looking at the act, considering it for enactment. And I include in your region California, Washington, Arizona, Utah, Wyoming, Idaho, and of course your great state, Oregon. There are a number of other states throughout the United States, also outside the western region, which are also attempting to deal with this problem and are using the Uniform Act as a basis for dealing with landlord-tenant difficulties. I understand that Commissioner Clark has appeared before you rather substantially with regard to the provisions of the Act. He's also submitted a statement, which I think will stand for my testimony this morning. And I would simply like to reemphasize, based upon what he's told me that as to what he has testified to, reemphasize a couple of points. The Uniform Act is an effort to achieve an equality between essential interests in the landlord and tenant relationship. It is an effort to provide fairness in the dealings between them. In order to do that, it emphasizes the concept of the agreement between the parties, provides a basis for establishing what shall be the obligations in the agreement between the parties, and should the agreement be broken, it provides, we think, for adequate remedies for those parties. The essential concept is fairness, and this is something that has been lacking in the law regarding this relationship as it's developed over the last really several hundred years in Anglo-American law. The agreement provides that the landlord shall provide fit and habitable premises. He shall provide possession of those premises according to the agreement, and the tenant shall provide rent and maintain, insofar as it is his capacity to maintain those premises, the fitness of the premises and the cleanliness of the premises. Simple obligations for the two parties to perform. In the event that the agreement is broken, it simply provides the basic remedy for any breach of contract, the seeking of damages in a court of law, with some additional remedies. Particularly for the tenant, there are some additional remedies. There is a repair and deduct provision provided for the tenant in the event that the breach of fitness problems is not substantial. There is an essential services remedy. If essential services are for some reason cut off to the tenant, he may provide them for himself, or he may provide himself other suitable premises, and the landlord may be required to pay for those. The landlord has in the bill the capacity to obtain reasonable access. He has the capacity with enforceable remedies to avoid abandonment problems, which are of difficulty in some areas, and he has the capacity to obtain from the tenant what is his due in terms of rent and the maintenance of the property. These features, I think, are simply the key features of the Act. We add to it some other potential remedies or some things which we think are needed with regard to the development of the relationship. I refer particularly to the retaliatory eviction potential of the Act. The Act provides a presumption in the event, provides a presumption that eviction is retaliatory if it's done within 1 year of the time a complaint is filed or a complaint is made regarding the fitness of the premises. With these provisions, the bill, I think, is a very complete bill. The bill is meant to be comprehensive, as are all conference bills. It is meant to very carefully fit together. We hope that Oregon, and I speak now for the conference, we hope that Oregon will give it serious consideration, and that in so doing, it will see fit to enact the Uniform Residential Landlord and Tenant Act. I would be glad to answer any questions if there are.
Questions, Senator Meeker?
section 41, line 17 and 18.
What page?
Page 9. Line 17 and 18. Make any repairs. To keep the premises fit and habitable, would you think that fit and habitable can be described in the bill? So my concern here is that, you know, what's fit and habitable for Joe may not be for Sam.
Yes, I think the B section of 21, and we're referring, I think, to one of the more general provisions in the entire part of section 21. Section 21 has, I think, some specific things that one would ordinarily consider to be part of a warranty of habitability. For example, maintain in good and safe working order, this is D, and condition all electrical, plumbing, sanitary, heating, ventilating, air conditioning, and other facilities and appliances. But I think with regard to dealing in a relationship, in particular a contractual relationship, I think it would be very difficult in an act such as this to delineate every possible problem of fitness. And I think the B section is designed to provide the kind of flexibility that is necessary in order to work out an equitable relationship between the parties.
Can I add a point here, Senator? When I appeared before, I suggested that one of the principles on which this act had been drafted was that much was to be left to the courts to put specific content into this relationship. We chose this road in order to avoid some of the problems which they have had in eastern states, where they have tried to define various parts of the landlord-tenant relationship in great detail. And they've had great trouble with that kind of legislation. Now, the concept of fit and habitable condition is no different, in our judgment, from many generalized concepts which courts deal with every day, such as due care, assumption of risk, this type of thing. There are many generalized standards, and a standard is what this provides. I'm sure that within the literature, we have now an annotated or a copy of the bill from the conference which has comments, and the comment to section 21 lists a number of states which now have, either by judicial decision or by statute, a requirement of a warrant, implied warranty of fit and habitable premises. I don't think that in terms of enforcement this presents any serious problem any more than any other general standard of the law presents a problem. The courts deal with this sort of thing every day. I agree with you that it would be nice if we could have a sharply defined thing so everybody would always know whether it was in or out. I don't think that's something you can deal with like that way.
Senator, you said that the courts have developed some standards and findings.
I say that there are many states which have a requirement of fit and habitable premises. Now, I have not examined the decisions of those states, but they are all going to be, they are all involved in the same problem you have raised. That is, they have to do it. And
Chairman, it's possible if I can do you have that?
I have a copy.
You can leave with it.
I can find it here. I have, and I will leave it here, and on this copy which I am leaving, Mr. Chairman, it's the January 31st Act as drafted with the comments. It is on page 22.
Can you leave that whole copy with us?
I will leave the entire copy, and I have marked in ink the corresponding section numbers of the Oregon Bill.
Thank you.
And the particular reference here is to page 22.
I would gather that's something that's all going to be like a copy. Make a copy that give to each member of the committee. What state did you say this Uniform Act is now pending before the legislature?
Well, there's a long list.
I thought you mentioned four or five.
I did. I mentioned those particularly in the western region.
Before other legislatures.
Oh, yes. Yes, I talked about those within the Rocky Mountain and western region. In the Midwest, I know it's been considered in Illinois. It's not yet introduced, but will be, I think, within this week. It's been considered in Iowa, or Nebraska, excuse me. I'm not sure of Iowa. It has been introduced in the state of Ohio. It's been considered in Vermont and in New Hampshire. I believe we'll have an imminent introduction in New York. So that we're getting North Carolina in the South. We're getting a great number of states that are considering the act as it's brought before you today.
Will everyone introduce the Michigan?
We're putting you on. We knew when you said that you came from the west that it wasn't Oregon.
I think it's Montana.
As a matter of fact, my home state, and up until July of this last year, was the state of Montana. I was assistant dean of the law school.
When I said all of our days are like this, I assumed that you hadn't been to Oregon before.
I've actually been in Oregon a great many times, so.
Any further questions? Senator Jernstedt.
In your testimony, you, when referring to the tenant, you said, referring to his ability to keep the place neat, that as far as it is within his ability to provide this neatness. Now,
well,
the standards here that seems to me are wide open, because some tenants can provide more in this area than others.
Well, what I think is the and Jim's pointing out the sections to me, to keep that part of the premise that he occupies and uses it as clean and safe as the condition of the premises permit, which is the language of the statute, as the conditions of the premises permit. I think insofar as he is capable of providing cleanliness and fit maintenance of the premises. If the premises are inherently bad to the point that the tenant has would almost have to exercise superhuman powers to obtain a given standard of cleanliness, I think the idea is that there'll be sufficient flexibility that we won't require of him the things that are superhuman in nature. For example, if he's dealing with a substantial cockroach problem that he cannot eliminate with any great ease, the fact that he has cockroaches, notwithstanding his efforts to get rid of them, not going to be able to be held against him.
Are there other questions? Thank you very much, gentlemen. We appreciate you coming out, Mr. McCabe, and your return.
I appreciate the chance to be here, and if there is anything else that the conference can provide in the way of information or service for Committee of the Oregon Legislature with regard to this bill, I wish that you would please let me know, and
yeah,
I'll see that it can be done.
Through Mr. Clark.
Yes, right. Easily.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
The more people have come in and I suspect want to testify, and here's the sign-up sheet here, I'm going to call on those people who are not from Salem first, in spite of the order that you signed up, because I assume it would be less difficult for those from Salem to return than other people. James Frost. Now, when you testify, we record everything so that the record's complete. I'd appreciate it if you state your name, who you represent, and your address so that we can communicate with you if we want.
My name is James Bross. I teach property at Northwestern School of Law at Lewis and Clark College in Portland. And I can add the usual disclaimer, I'm not representing the law school, I'm representing myself. Before going into the teaching profession, I worked in law reform units of legal services programs in Washington, D.C. and Philadelphia. And while in those cities, I had occasion to take part in the fairly active changes that were going on in landlord and tenant law in both those areas. I think it's an indication of the activity that's going on that the annotations that are added to this bill are already outdated. Another state has had a Supreme Court imply a warranty of habitability since these annotations have come down. Iowa has been added to the list. Iowa has had its Supreme Court imply a warranty of habitability in housing since the annotations were prepared.
I'm not a lawyer, but
It means that the kind of thing this act is attempting to do by legislative action has occurred by judicial action in the state of Iowa. There's an attempt in the annotations to list the states where that has happened, and that list prepared on the 30th of January is already outdated because the change is occurring so rapidly in this area.
Do you have a citation for that case?
I can give you a Poverty Law Reporter citation for it. The Poverty Law Reporter citation is to paragraph 16,110.
No, I'm talking about the citation of the case.
That's what I'm talking about. It has not yet been, I don't have a state cite for it. It was reported in Poverty Law Reporter. I think you'll find those similar citations are in the annotations. But the Poverty Law Reporter citation is paragraph 16,110.
What's that a citation?
Before cases come down in the state reporters or advance sheets, the Poverty Law Reporter often picks up a state Supreme Court decision, and you'll find its citation, as it is in the annotations to the act that have been prepared, will be to the Poverty Law Reporter first, and then as the state citations come available, it will be made available through the state citations. It's the earliest notice one might have of a change in law. In any event, while participating in this change, I had occasion to represent both tenants, and if they were poor enough, I represented landlords. And it was presented to me in a way that made it seem at least facially plausible that the changes we were making might disrupt the housing market in a way that would cause increases in rent and disappearance of some landlords from the business. In addition to that, the most disturbing possibility to me was presented was that...
Just a minute. We're here to hear testimony on this bill so we can learn about it. Now, if you're here for any other reason, I suggest you go out in the hall and take care of it. While you're in here, be quiet so we can hear. When you want to talk, we'll call you up here, you're signed up as a witness, and then you can talk. Otherwise, I'd like it to be quiet. Excuse me. You continue.
The most disturbing possibility that was presented to me was that sound houses would be driven out of the market because of the requirements of law reform. And I was disturbed enough by this possibility to decide that I ought to make a study of what actually happened when landlord and tenant law reform was implemented in an area where a housing market was at least marginal and possibly subject to severe consequences from a change in the law. I studied the housing market in the city of Philadelphia in some of the neighborhoods that were very marginal in terms of maintenance and rent levels, the kinds of neighborhoods that would be least able to respond to a change in law that would change, in a sense, the ground rules on which landlord and tenant law was based. Many of the changes that occurred over the period I studied are similar to changes proposed in the Uniform Residential Landlord and Tenant Act. For example, there were protections against retaliatory eviction and retaliatory rent increases imposed during the time of my study. There was a rent withholding remedy imposed by state legislation during the time of my study. Distraint was declared unconstitutional by the Eastern District of Pennsylvania during the time of my study. And so the changes in ground rules were basically similar in effect on the housing market to the kind we're talking about here. And it provided an opportunity to find out if the kinds of disastrous consequences I'd been hearing, which seemed likely to me, might in fact occur. I studied about 4,000 houses and the pattern of their market.
Just a second. Mr. Clark, are you familiar with this decision of the Iowa Supreme Court?
I am not. Matter of fact, I haven't been able to hear the testimony.
Yeah, I know. I think you'll be able to hear from now on, I'm going to say.
In any event, I studied the patterns of these 4,000 houses and their rent increases, with regard to improvement in conditions as, say, rent withholding was used. And most significant to me, I wanted to find out if, in fact, it was true that good houses were being driven out of the housing market because of changes in law. What I discovered in my study of 4,000 houses was that there were some houses that no longer were available for rental after a change such as this occurred. They were in general the kind of housing which could be described as unfit for human habitation. On the average, the houses that disappeared from the housing market had 120 points in violation of the Philadelphia Housing Code. 120 points would mean, for example, four walls unsound to the maximum extent and a missing roof. That's the kind of house that disappeared from the market. There was, in fact, improvement in many of the houses that were available when rent withholding as a remedy was used by tenants, when protections from a retaliatory eviction were imposed, and when distraint stopped. And in general, the housing market was able to respond, if not by, not necessarily always by improvement, certainly by maintaining its prior level of housing availability. I was originally pessimistic about the effects of landlord and tenant law and changes in it when I began my study. My pessimism was not justified by what I found in fact. In fact, the housing market was quite capable of responding to the changes that were made in landlord and tenant law. Not only did housing improve, the rent increases were almost non-existent. I talked to managers who managed as many as 600 properties in slum areas, whose response was that we can maintain, in fact, without increasing rent. And they maintained that same position even with the landlord and tenant reform that occurred. I would suggest that the areas I studied in Philadelphia were in much worse condition than any housing market that this law is likely to affect. I studied areas where as much as 20% of the housing was already abandoned before anyone tried to change landlord and tenant law. And even in those areas, the housing market was able to respond by some improvement and, in general, a slight increase in maintenance levels without housing going off the market. I would like to be able to give you this morning a copy of my article that summarizes these findings, but we're having at the law school a kind of copying crisis. When it alleviates, I will forward to the committee copies of a summary of the article I'm referring to in summarizing the findings.
Excuse me, Senator Carson. Maybe one copy. We can duplicate it here.
All right.
Our crisis is not. We've had one last week, but we're out of our moment.
I'm sure Senator Burns wouldn't want his alumni fees to go up if we.
Yes, we don't want to.
No, we don't.
Have enough trouble raising money for school.
I did want to present possibly a comment on Senator Meeker's question on the vague standard of habitability. In Philadelphia and in a couple of other jurisdictions that I dealt with, there was an attempt to define habitability in terms of the housing code. The first problem that comes up there in a state like Oregon is that there are many areas, rural areas, that don't have a housing code that would necessarily be applicable, and you would have difficulty defining it that way. Another problem that comes up is that when you use the housing code as a standard and allow the professionals to define what they mean by habitability, they often do not reflect the needs and desires of the people who live and work in housing. It tends to be in terms of public health, fire prevention needs, and not in terms of needs as perceived by people who live in housing. For example, you could have the worst imaginable infestation of rats and roaches. It would not make your housing uninhabitable by public housing health code standards. I suspect in a trial court situation that might well have an effect on diminution of rent. The advantage of the vague standard is it allows fact finders in a variety of situations across the state with as many varieties as the state of Oregon presents to standardize, not standardize for a state, but standardize for the area. Their perceptions of what housing and habitability means. I think it has a definite advantage for a statewide act that you could not get from attempting to define habitability for a whole state.
Senator Meeker.
Did the Iowa Supreme Court, you did say Iowa.
Yeah, that was the most recent one.
Did the Iowa Supreme Court case get into this problem with definition?
As in most of the decisions that you'll find cited in the annotations and also the Iowa Supreme Court, it's a little bit like passing uniform commercial code. After you say implied warranty of fitness, then we'll leave it up to the cases to define it. I think that's the kind of process we're looking at when you use a standard like implied warranty of habitability. It will, in effect, be a case-by-case definition.
Thank you.
not that we are unable to cope with that kind of definition process. It's one that the common law has been using for 1,000 years, and it has the advantage of attuning the standards you devise to realities and not to...
I'm not debating this philosophy. I'm wondering if the Iowa Supreme Court case defines habitability, human habitability.
The only attempts that have been made to define it in terms of saying, as the D.C. courts have said, the housing code provides a suitable standard to which to look. There is no such thing as a definition of habitability that you can carry around with you with a list of standards.
What did the Iowa case do?
It said that we will imply in all landlord and tenant relationships an implied warranty of habitability, and it will have the same sort of effect that this act would have here. We'll have to figure out what that means on a case-by-case basis.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? Senator Carson.
In your study of the 4,000 homes in Philadelphia, when was that study made?
This was made in 1971. I studied the periods of 69 to 71.
This was the landlord tenant change was made in 69?
Well, it was made over the course of that period. The Rent Withholding Act went into effect in late 69. The retaliatory eviction protections went into effect in early 70. The distraint case happened in late 70. So that over the period, a variety of changes had occurred, similar to the kinds of changes that would occur when this legislation was passed.
Do you think that apparently you anticipated an immediate change, your pessimism, as you call it, an immediate change, and didn't find it? Does that give you any comfort to think that the changes are not to take place now?
Well, the kind of change that I think you can expect immediately is that there are a lot of houses not being maintained. If for some reason, for example, the fact that the tenant's no longer paying rent until his residence has improved, the landlord's cash flow stops, and he's required to make a significant improvement. While his cash flow is stopped, that could result in, I think, a sudden disappearance of a house from the market, because the landlord might not be able to respond to the pressure to maintain while he is also losing his cash flow. That did not occur. If he is able in the short run to make that drastic repair, which will undoubtedly occur as the first pressure occurs for repair, places have not been maintained regularly in a lot of instances. If he brings it up to habitability the first time while his cash flow is interrupted, I suspect that he will be able in the long run also to maintain, because he's made that first initial repair and been able to respond to the worst possible impact of the bill, namely the interruption of cash flow with a big improvement in maintenance.
And you are assuming, or that although there's no study in Oregon, we've not made the change, that we would be no worse and perhaps better than Philadelphia.
Well, I don't think you have any housing markets that are as unhealthy as the ones I studied in Philadelphia. You certainly don't have any with a 20-30% vacancy rate around here.
Maybe not in Portland, but Salem's a little different.
Are there any other questions? Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony, and you will forward us a copy.
A copy.
Thank you very much. Representative Katz?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm going to be very brief because there are...
Be a little bit louder, too.
What's my name? For the record, my name is Vera Katz, and I live at 1214 Northwest 25th Avenue. I'm going to be very brief because they're Portland, Oregon. District 8, Northwest, Southwest Portland. I'm not going to speak to the technicalities of the bill. I understand you had Mr. Clark and Mr. Williamson and other people addressing themselves to that particular aspect. I'm here as a tenant, probably one of the very few tenants, full-year tenants, at the legislature. I am somewhat hesitant in appearing here today because of the fear, excuse me, of retaliatory eviction. Though Mr. Herb Hardy has guaranteed that he would represent me in court in case I am evicted or received.
We have a lot of tenant cases. Please,
Let me briefly describe the area that I represent. It probably has the highest concentration of renters in the entire state of Oregon. In the Northwest Flats, over 80% of the people living there rent. Many of them are single women, elderly, spinsters, divorcees, or widowers. Most of them all work or retired. They cannot move. It is a difficult process for them to pick up their belongings and move from one apartment to another. And so many landlords say, well, if you don't like this particular apartment, move. And that is a difficulty and a hardship for many of these people. As a tenant, I have had some personal problems. Let me run down some of them. We do not get consistent and steady heat. And I know what the codes in Portland require, but our apartment happens to be drafty. So I have to, in addition to whatever heat we get, use the oven or an electric heater to heat the apartment. That adds, about $10 to the monthly bill. At one point, my landlord responded, if you're cold, put on a sweater, or if you're cold, put on a coat and run around the block. Any complaints that I or anybody else in the apartment house would have made would have been enough and sufficient for the landlord to tell us that if we are not pleased with our residence, we have 30 days to move. Many of the repairs in the apartment have to be made by ourselves. We have no lease. And the constant fear of retaliatory eviction is with us every day, even to the extent of rent increase. We were told if the landlords increase the rent, and it is not within the guidelines of the federal government, that there was a number to call and to make a complaint. I called that particular number, made a complaint, but was also warned by the federal representative at the IRS department that it would be possible for me to be evicted. Not on the complaint, but 2 months later on something else. And I would not, as a tenant, be protected. During the campaign, I had numerous calls, all threats of retaliatory eviction. One was very interesting, and we were considering taking it into court, but there were other things to do to the campaign. A young man decided that he wanted to put a window sign of mine in his window and was requested by the landlord to remove it for 30 days. And these are the kinds of things that the tenants have to live with all the time. I can honestly say that I have felt like a second-class citizen. I'm accused at some point of being un-American because I don't own property. I rent. I rented in the East Coast, and I probably will continue renting here. I've been accused of being a transient, not caring about my community. I won't comment on that. And I have been accused of not paying property taxes because I rent. And I think we all know that those who rent pay property taxes, that the property taxes leveled on the landlord get passed on to the renter, and we cannot deduct it. I think the laws of the state must guarantee the tenants equal rights and protection under the law. It's a big task. We tried during the 71 session. We weren't very successful. I hope that you gentlemen take a look at this seriously and consider those who are renting, primarily in the urban areas where we have a real high concentration of renters, many of them elderly and single people.
Any questions, Representative Katz? Senator Dickey.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Katz, you talked about being threatened
to be evicted. Have you ever been evicted?
No, no. I consider myself a fairly good tenant. But I have felt I have not been evicted, but other people in my apartment house have been asked to leave. And the thing is, you're constantly under that threat, with the knowledge that if you complain, and complain too often, that you might be evicted. And it's kind of a psychological veil that hangs over you. And it is not pleasant to live under those conditions. There were days in the winter when that apartment was cold, and you complain only so often. After a while, that fear is there, and you stop complaining and turn on the oven.
Senator Gernstein.
Representative Katz, how long have you lived with your present address?
6 or 7 years.
Did you have other questions? Yes, I did.
I'm sorry, sir.
I'm sorry. His question leads me to ask another question, and that would be, Representative Katz, in the 6 or 7 years of time, how often has the rent been increased? And you indicated that it went beyond the guidelines of the federal government. Could you indicate for us what the case was in the district?
All right, the rent, I can't give you, let me give you the range. The rent was at 85 and is now at 125. And it's been increased, I think, 3 or 4 times, maybe 3 times. I don't have the records with me. I'm not prepared to answer that question at this time. There are certain guidelines that the federal government set regarding rent increases. You had to have the rent spelled out, what it was before the increase, you know, what it is now, what the increase is for, what percentage of increase. That was not given to us. I was aware of it. I called the federal government office and then was told that that's fine, you can complain, we can process the complaint and admit very likelihood that you'll be reimbursed. But on the other hand, he told me that it's very likelihood that you may be asked to leave.
Another question.
Does that answer your question?
One in here. Would you consider in your area or in your district that there's a housing shortage? Or you may not have any reason.
No, there is a shortage. And one of the reasons is that a lot of these houses are owned by absentee landlords. They are not maintained, they are run down, and eventually fingered for demolishing. And most of them, a lot of them, are in a commercial use zone. Consequently, as soon as they go down, the zone is proper to have a commercial something built that would fit the commercial zoning patterns. So we have a housing shortage. We have a housing shortage because we have expansion of the hospital. We have a housing shortage because we have expansion of the freeway. And that is a problem. But most of these places that I'm referring to that are being torn down will not be fit for people to live in within the next 5 or 6 years.
Another question? Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Grinnell.
Let's see. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Representative Bill Grinnell. For the record, I reside at 438 Northwood Road, North Bend. Actually, I'm going to be brief. I'm going to speak to a specific amendment, I have 3 copies, and I'll pass on up to the chairman. This particular amendment would take place on page 4 of the printed bill on line 2, simply deleting the period and inserting the words, and the term shall include, or the term includes, space rented or offered to any person in a mobile home park is defined in subsection 4 of ORS 446.002. The reason for this amendment is that many renters, particularly many renters outside of metropolitan areas, are people who in fact are renting in mobile home parks. And the reason for this specific amendment was an example that came to my attention approximately 2 or 3 weeks ago. when a couple by the name of Mr. and Mrs. John Ark from North Bend, who had been tenants in a trailer park for about 2 years, living in a rather nice mobile home. It was positioned on a regular site, and there was another mobile home on another site adjacent to them. The ownership of the trailer court changed hands to a California outfit. When they came in, they decided that they could get more spaces out of the park. So they moved a number of trailers in between these trailers. Chapter 446 of ORS is very specific concerning the space between the kinds of sanitary facilities you have to provide, that sort of thing, and it rests this in the hands of the county sanitarian to decide. These people, nonetheless, needless to say, were a little bit disturbed, but the one particular fact bothered them, the fact that the fuel barrels from this trailer that was moved in between them was only 6 feet from their back porch. So they went to county sanitarian to inquire about this, and they received a letter back from them saying, this is from the county sanitarian, it's my considered opinion that the spacing between the trailers should be 15 feet because of the fire hazard involved in closer spacing. So as enclosed, find a copy of 446090 that exempts subsection 3 of ORS 446.100, and so on and so forth, referring to the statute. But anyway, signed the county sanitarian. They pointed this out to the landlord, and they then received in their neighbors, the two tenants that had been there the longest, a couple of years or so, both received a letter to this effect. On advisement of Coos County Health Department, we find that the trailer in your immediate area of Glasgow Mobile Homes Court are not in compliance with state law, which requires 15 feet of space as necessary between each unit. In order to meet the requirement, it will be necessary for us to revise these spaces, the four spaces from 2030 to 2036. Unfortunately, your mobile home would obstruct this revision. Therefore, it's necessary for me to advise you that you have 30 days from the receipt of this letter to move your mobile home and vacate the premises. We regret this action must be taken and trust that you will be able to locate in another suitable site. Retaliatory action, in my judgment. Well, that's just some of the kinds of examples, but I think that in this bill, if you're going to consider tenant-landlord relationships, you might want to consider mobile homes also.
Senator Carson? Representative Grinnell, have you gone through the bill? I hear the point you're speaking to, but I wonder, are you concerned at all? And I haven't thought the thing out, but one deals with land. The present bill primarily deals with units. And is there any conflict with all of a sudden the landlord becomes a warrantor of the individual mobile unit?
No, I think that might be interpreted as a conflict in that. And in discussing this with legislative counsel this morning, we discussed that. And he thought, well, perhaps the intent here is kind of obvious, that we're not talking about the mobile home itself, but rather the site. But if, in fact, that would confuse the intent in other portions of the bill, then I think that probably amendments to that effect would have to be in there.
Further questions? Thank you, Representative Grinnell.
Thank you.
I'm going to call witnesses that are not in Salem. Mr. Galvin, you indicated you had some. Could you come back at another date in view of the fact that you are here in Salem?
Sure. There's one other meeting, and this is the second time.
Around?
Yeah, why you don't I'll do it in 3 minutes. I know someone told that before.
Yeah. Okay, come on.
My name is Mark Galvin. I'm a legal worker with the Miriam Polk Legal Aid. Okay, what I'm going to try to show is that this bill, to dismiss the popular belief that it only...
Linda Yates.
There seems to be a popular belief that this would only benefit Portland and Eugene residents, namely students in Eugene and the general population in Portland. I have some statistics from our legal aid. These are compiled from the last seven quarters, from March 71. The total number of accepted cases are 2,319. Total cases of private landlord is 214, which is 9%. The two most significant decreases were the number of private landlord-tenant cases are significantly lower, would be during the summer periods, which might indicate that during the summer the heat's not needed. People can more easily use outdoors for certain things. And it's just, you know, generally they're able to move a lot easier. The other statistics, I mean, the other thing I'd like to present is 11 endorsements from area Salem groups, Marion Polk County groups, actually. If somebody wants to take these. Did you get an OCE endorsement? Is an OCE endorsement? Okay. The groups endorsing this bill are Polk County Housing Authority and Urban Renewal Agency, City of Salem Housing Authority and Urban Renewal Agency, the Oregon State Council for Senior Citizens Legislative Committee, the Polk County ADC Mothers Club, the Mid-Willamette Valley Council on Aging, the Oregon Committee for Progress Through Law, the Centro Chicano Cultural, the Valley Migrant League, the AD Association of Lane County Incorporated, Chicano Indian Study Center of Oregon, and Mr. W.K. Graber, the building administrator for Marion County. To look at these, I think that they're extremely important because, once again, it dismisses the belief that this is solely a student bill. We have here like housing specialists, two elderly groups, minority groups, and just groups looking for change through law. So it's not, you know, the belief that a lot of people have.
Thank you. Did you want to testify?
Yes. Mark Gavin called me last week, and I spoke to some of the students. My name is Linda Yagi, and I'm from OCE. And I spoke to some of the students who are renting in the Monmouth area and have for the past couple of years. I represent them, but I also represent some of the managers and owners of apartment houses in Monmouth. I think it's something that is wanted by both parties in that area because of the conflicts that occur between students who are renting or families who are renting in the area and the landlords who own the apartment. They feel that the renters do not understand what the verbal contract entails. The renter does not feel that the manager is treating them in a sufficient manner for them to live in a good condition with guarantees that they won't be evicted if they want to complain about something. I would like to relate to you something that happened to me. I have affidavits from two other students. I have been in contact with other students who didn't have time to write it out for me. But last summer, between June 15th and August 15th, I rented a summer apartment in Monmouth. A friend of mine and I moved into the apartment, which was already occupied by a girl who had lived there for 2 years. When we moved in, the apartment had not been cleaned by the manager because the girl was already living there and we were moving in as her roommate. We both put a $20 deposit down on the apartment for a cleaning deposit, although there was no cleaning done when we moved in. In fact, the manager came over the day I moved in and I cleaned the whole day while she was there talking to me. At that time. 6 weeks, it was about 2 months later when we moved out. The other roommate had already moved out a month previously and left her deposit in full after she had lived there 2 years. We had the apartment manager come over after we did general cleaning in the apartment for 2 days. It included cleaning an oven which had not been cleaned for at least a year. It took 4 hours and 5 coats of oven cleaner to get it cleaned. We did other general cleaning in the apartment. 6 weeks later, after the apartment manager had okayed the apartment and said she would send our deposits to us by mail, I contacted her because she had not sent us the deposit. My friend had already gone to her house and obtained 15 of the $20 deposit that she had put down. I went over and argued my case because I felt that we had spent 2 days cleaning the apartment, which was in worse condition when we moved in than it was when we moved out. She insisted that the apartment needed a great deal of repair, which I agreed with her since tenants had been living there for 2 to 3 years before we moved in. But the list of things that she had to complain about in damages to the apartment were inflicted by the girl who lived there before and had a guinea pig and let it run around the house loose. Sounds ridiculous, but things like this do happen. The manager insisted upon keeping part of my deposit until I got quite irate. I told her that if I ever wanted to rent from her again, I would have to consider her actions, since I only rented from in that area during the summertime. She finally wrote me out a check for $20 because she didn't want to cause any hard feelings, but my other friend who lived in the apartment still has not received her money because she did not go in and pound her feet and say she wanted her money back. A lot of renters do not want to hassle for weeks or months or go to court over getting anywhere from $5 to $150 back on deposit. They don't feel that they will win the case because they believe that most laws are written in the benefit of the manager or owner of the apartment. Most are not familiar with the laws that exist today, and as I will show you, we have an apartment renter's handbook put out by Osberg on the campus of OCE. If you look through this, I only have one copy. You will notice that most of the agreements made for all apartments in town are verbal agreements. There are very few that are written. They are listed here if they are. Most agreements which are verbal cannot be stated to the renter. I mean, in a situation where when he comes back and has been deprived of the deposit, he cannot say that, you know, this was what was told him the day he moved in. There's no proof of that. I'd like to leave that with you and ASOCE's Tenants Union Handbook. And I would like to voice my support to Senate Bill 159.
Thank you. Are there any questions you would like? Jonathan Hoffman.
My name is Jonathan Hoffman. I live at 922 Polk Street, Eugene, Oregon. I'm a law student at the University of Oregon. I speak as one who helps in the management of my family's business and residential rental property, and thus I feel I can appreciate some of the problems that landlords experience. And as a matter of fact, we have a tenant right now that we're trying to kick out, so I'm not speaking simply as an ex-tenant.
You indicated you're speaking on behalf of the bill.
Yes, I am. I've also lived in a Boston tenement, one owned by the largest slumlord in Boston, where the landlord would shut off the heat on weekends in February when it was 10 degrees outside, and where janitors were paid in wine, where cockroaches were everywhere, where 6 Puerto Ricans died in a fire on the top floor of one of the buildings several doors down because there were no fire escapes, which was in direct violation of the city building code, and where the landlord once boasted publicly that he had every building inspector in the city paid off. Of course, we live in Oregon, and we'd like to think that we experience no such problems. But the problems are here, and they're becoming more acute every day, and they're not restricted to a few diverse areas in Portland and Eugene. I endorse Senate Bill number 159 not because it provides all the answers, but because it is at least a step, albeit a small one, toward guaranteeing tenants the right to live in safe, sanitary, and decent conditions. It begins to alleviate the disparity in bargaining power between landlords and tenants, and it begins to bring the law of property out of the 13th century and into the 18th or even 19th. But I would be amiss in my duty if I testified that because of the passage of this bill, all the housing problems in the state of Oregon will be eliminated. Please do not misunderstand. This bill is unquestionably a tremendous improvement over the present landlord-tenant law in Oregon. But there are several serious shortcomings, and therefore I'd like to propose the following amendments. Would you like a copy of the statement and amendments? Number one doesn't really have to do with landlords and tenants as such, but I think it's a jurisdictional thing which the committee should be aware of. Section 9, lines 31 and 32, page 2, presently reads, "The circuit or district court of the state may exercise jurisdiction over any landlord," and so forth. As I understand it, the legislature in the last year, or since 71, has gone to some pains to establish original and exclusive jurisdiction for district courts over minor matters. And so my recommendation is that those lines be amended to read something to the effect of, "Subject to the monetary and jurisdictional limits as provided by statute, the circuit or district court of the state may exercise jurisdiction over any landlord," and so forth.
Yes, Senate Bill 450, which was passed in the last session and provided that if not repealed by this session, becomes law on July 1 of 73 this year, then the district court would have exclusive jurisdiction in all cases involving $3,500 or less.
This would not involve a contradiction of that? If I was a tenant, it seems to imply that I can bring my action in either the circuit or the district court, regardless of monetary amount.
Well, what was your proposal?
Well, simply that subject to, I don't know how you'd want to word it, but subject to either the monetary jurisdictional limits as provided elsewhere by statute.
Well, I have a question about that. I think maybe that would resolve it, but didn't we last session in the comprehensive consumer package give original jurisdiction in the circuit court? I had a case on one of the first ones in court under the new consumer, it was a fraud case, and the district judge, well,
anyway, something to consider. The second proposal is page 8, section 18, section 18, part 2, lines 5 to 11. I find that the wording of that section doesn't really help landlords or tenants. And I propose that section 2 be amended to read, quote, "Upon termination of the tenancy, property or money held by the landlord may be applied to the payment of accrued rent, period. Otherwise, the landlord must return the security deposit with 4% interest within 14 days of the termination of the tenancy, except A, if the landlord or his agent and the tenant jointly sign an inventory list at the inception of the tenancy, listing all material defects in the dwelling and its furnishings, and take a second inventory signed by both parties prior to the termination of the tenancy, the landlord may deduct the damages he has sustained by reason of the tenant's noncompliance with Section 23 of this Act."
Well, Mr. Chairman, isn't that a good idea? Are you saying that
I'm simply saying that as a matter of proof, it's much nicer to have something that both parties have signed at the beginning and the end than having the landlord mail something 14 days after the tenancy is over.
Oh, I see. You're asking to have an inventory.
Yeah.
Right. It presently implies it, but I think both parties are better off with that. And B, something I add with some trepidation, because I also appreciate the problems with cleaning, saying something to the effect of, "The landlord may deduct a reasonable cleaning fee from the security deposit, provided that such fee is not to exceed 20% of the security deposit or $35, whichever is less, and provided that all monies deducted for cleaning be used for that purpose." I think a landlord is entitled to some kind of money to make some cleaning in an interim between tenants. The fear I have is that an awful lot of landlords might use such a section to keep the money and not do the cleaning, because I've rented three times, and each time I've paid a cleaning deposit, and not once have I ever moved into a clean apartment.
You think it's a good idea to put a specified amount in the law when there's such a variance in the size of an apartment, or inflation comes along and changes?
Well, again, I'm not sure. I'm proposing this simply as a matter to consider. Maybe the ideal thing would be a percentage based upon the rental value of the apartment. The two things that I'm primarily considered with in this proposal are first, this element of proof involved in reclaiming a security deposit. Second, you may have also noticed that I added a provision about interest. It seemed to me that if you're leaving with a landlord, what is often $200 can even be more than $200 for a period upwards of 1 year in many cases. It seems to me that you and not the landlord are entitled to the earnings on that money when he puts it in the bank for safekeeping. The cleaning deposit thing, I don't know. I'm just throwing it out as something to consider as a possible amendment.
Anybody have any questions?
I have a question
on this area. Apparently the reason for a cleaning deposit is kind of a real purpose of it is to try to induce tenants to be clean. Because it was just a matter of cost, well, all you have to do is add the rent. That's the purpose of cleaning deposit. Were you finished testifying?
Yes, I just have a little bit more. And actually, this is the most important thing, is Section 27, page 13, actually the middle of it. And in addition, on page 14, Section 28, first, Section 27. I want the same change, and I'd like to see the same change on both of them. Section 27, Part 2, lines 20 to 22. That it be amended to read that the line that says, if the landlord's noncompliant, be amended to read, the court may award a reasonable attorney's fees to the prevailing party. And similarly, on page 14, line 8, that the phrase "and reasonable attorney's fees" be struck, and that a third subsection be put in that says, in an action for possession, the court may award reasonable attorney's fees to the prevailing party. I think it's a crucial matter because, as a matter of proof, it's virtually impossible to prove that a landlord is willfully failing to comply with the act. And yet, the matter of attorney's fees is a really serious problem in that knowing that you may have to get an attorney to get your rights under this law is a very effective deterrent to someone exercising his rights. And it seems to me that simply allowing the court to award attorney's fees to the prevailing party, reasonable attorney's fees, makes it much easier for tenants to exercise their rights under the law.
Where was second place you were going to do that?
Second place is Section 28. Oh, it's on page 14, Section 28, line 8. Again, that section has to do with willfulness. And I'd strike the phrase reasonable attorney's fees, and I'd put in another section which would simply say, in an action for possession, the court may award reasonable attorney's fees to the prevailing party. The reason, as I understand it, that courts have been very reluctant to award attorney's fees for tenants is that they don't want tenants harassing landlords over frivolous actions in court all the time. Allowing the court to award attorney's fees to the prevailing party would mean that you know that you're not going to get your attorney's fees unless you have at least some kind of just cause in the first place. But if you've got to go into court to seek $200 in damages, it isn't going to help you very much knowing that you can win if you're going to have to pay $300 for your attorney. Anyway, that's all I had to say.
Any other questions? Better than me. It
appears that you've given the bill a great deal of study, and I was interested in your reaction to the findings that we discussed earlier. And I want to point out that in some of the testimonies provided, for example, from the Long Island Valley Council on aging, the people supporting the bill indicated that even they would like to have some idea of what's happening.
Yeah. Yes, I do. I think if you read the, and I felt this the first time I read the bill, it seemed to have an awful lot of indefinite terms in it about reasonableness and what is habitability and what is, you know, reasonably clean and reasonably safe and so forth. I think the reason that those words are advantageous to the bill is this. Under current property law, it's really the landlord that holds all the marbles, and there's very little that a tenant can do. What the bill does, in effect, I think, is to take all of the bargaining, or take some of the bargaining power away from the landlord, where it presently all resides, and put it in a neutral and detached supervisory agency, namely the court, and allows the court to sit back and look at the landlord and the tenant as two equal parties, both with certain rights, and to simply decide what's reasonable. I don't think that present law, at least present landlord-tenant law, really gives the court enough flexibility to do that. In other words, I think it's basically so that tenants can seek and receive equity. It's reasonably habitable. If you can bring evidence that shows that a place is obviously not habitable, then the court would decide in your favor. I think this kind of flexibility is necessary because the individual circumstances of different tenants and landlords are very different in each circumstance.
Senator Carter. Well, if I may just pursue that, we've got some testimony that when an individual is cold, that one individual is a habitation requirement. And the landlord, that's not unique with renters. I suggest that happens to homeowners too, between one person and another. As to one witness, it was inhabitable because it was not warm enough. Is that what you foresee, that we're getting down to a temperature standard for habitation?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, you've got to be practical about it, because if you've got the electricity turned up all the way and it's 10 degrees outside, and it's only 65 in the apartment, tenant may not like it, but it's doubtful that he'd sue anyway. If it's 10 degrees in the apartment, of course, it isn't 10 degrees that often in Oregon. It was. if it's about 10 degrees in the apartment, it's more likely that they'd bring an action. In other words, I think those kinds of marginal cases that you're talking about, something about degrees of temperature, someone isn't going to, they may be a little upset about it, but they're probably not going to sue in the first place.
The point I'm getting at is what you're saying is you're resting your supporters in this area to Senator Meeker's question on that the court will determine the reasonableness of the habitation, mm-hmm. even though I, as a tenant, may say I can't live under those circumstances.
Right.
So it's uninhabitable for me.
I guess.
The court may say for the average cat it's okay.
Yeah. I guess what I'm saying is that it's more reasonable that courts are designed for exactly that purpose, that is to determine reasonable standards in various circumstances, and that it's far more advantageous to give that power to a court than to leave it to individual landlords and tenants to scream at each other.
Or to write it in and say maximum required at 7 feet.
Yeah, exactly.
Senator Meeker. Mr. Chairman, I'm getting the distinct impression that this is a lawyer's bill, because we've had every law school with one exception is going to be funded by them. They're on the list. And I'm also beginning to get the idea that since everything's going to be determined in the court, it just depends on whether or not you've got a good attorney and when you win the case. If that's the case, then perhaps we should define that you have both to protect the tenant.
I think, well, it's a good point. I think the problem is that, see, I don't think you want to define it, because I really think that it's the kind of standard that's got to be flexible. The thing is that there's a very practical problem. As you say, in a way, it is a lawyer's bill. If a tenant doesn't know about this bill, or even if he knows about it but hasn't had a first-year course in property, it really may not help him very much. If I work in legal aid society, I think what I would like to do once this bill was passed was go around and leave it on everybody's doorstep. The problem is that this bill is only as effective as people are willing to utilize it. When I lived in Massachusetts, there was a really tremendous housing bill. It had virtually every provision that's in this. It didn't make any difference first because most of the tenants that were being aggrieved were Puerto Ricans and people who did not know what their rights were, and of course second, because our particular slumlord really did have everybody in the city paid off.
Was that Harvard?
Well, no, Harvard's the biggest slumlord in the city of Cambridge. Morris Gordon. Morris Gordon is the biggest slumlord in the city of Boston.
Do they have a law like another labor?
Similar to this. Again, you see any.
I'm sorry.
But the point, to make it very brief, the point that is important is this. Under any law that you pass, it's not likely that everyone who needs a remedy is going to get. Is going to know his rights and stand up for his rights. The point is that without this law, tenants have no rights at all. And at least it gives them the opportunity to achieve some kind of flexibility in a courtroom as opposed to going to their landlord and asking for pity.
Thank you very much, Mr. Hoffman, for the time you put in sending this bill and sharing your thoughts with us. Now, I had to organize this a little bit so that we're going to have the next session on this bill. We're going to go now for about another 45 minutes. The next session on this bill is going to be on February 22nd at 8:30, and that's going to be for opponents only. There's one gentleman here to sign up as an opponent. He's from Salem, and he'll be given an opportunity to testify at that time, not today. There's about seven people from the Eugene area, and I'm wondering if you know each other and you got individual experiences, or there's any way we can kind of reduce that testimony down to one or two, and yet you'll all feel that you express yourself. I don't know, maybe you're all up here independently. Anybody know?
I'm one of those, and I've got testimony from about 25 myself, which I've written testimony, which I'd like to submit to you.
About 25?
Yeah. Other written statements.
Oh, you got their state?
Yes.
Well, that's the kind of thing we like to do. yes.
I'm another. I'm with a large group that came up, but I also represent a group of about 400 people that have been coming to see you never had.
Well, I just wonder if we can reduce the seven down to about two or something like that.
I'm a very individual case. I would like to appear.
Are you from Eugene?
I'm from Springfield.
Springfield. Well, let's, we'll take those three and then we'll see what other people in Eugene, what they want to do. Can you tell us your name, please?
My name is Tom Hanlon. I'm an attorney in Springfield at the firm of Babcock & Ackerman. And I appear as an individual.
That'll keep you on good standing with
me. I do have, before I go into my testimony, some cites on cases that Supreme Courts of other states have talked about this implied warranty of habitability, if you'd like those.
Yes, I'm sure we would.
Okay. There are two of them, one from Illinois and one from New Jersey. Jack Spring Incorporated versus Little, and the site is 280 Northeast 2nd 208, a 1972 case.
208?
280 Northeast 2nd 208. And the New Jersey case, Marini versus Ireland, is 265 Atlantic 2nd 526, a 1970 case. So those are a couple of cases that discuss that.
That's good.
And also, Mr. Frank Wall from the off-campus housing at the University of Oregon has given me statements of about 25 individuals who have come into his office who do support the bill. And I would like to submit that to the chairman, along with my testimony. Our law firm does legal services for the students at the University of Oregon. And last year, in 1972, we saw 1,462 students, and of those, 356, or 24.4%, were tenants who had disputes with their landlords. And the three major complaints that I've gotten out of these were: one, unwarranted retention of security deposits; two, abuse of the landlord lien rights; that is getting locked out of your apartment or getting goods wrongfully withheld when there was already monetary security with the landlord. And third, refusal of the landlords to keep rental units up to minimum city code standards. It's my belief that Senate Bill 159 will equalize the bargaining power of the landlords and tenants. It's been estimated that approximately 30% of all claims filed in small claims courts across the United States involve unwarranted retention of security deposits by landlords. And that's out of Consumer Reports in 1971. I believe that the 14-day itemization or return of deposit in Senate Bill 159 would be a feasible solution to this problem and would probably keep a lot of these cases out of the small claims courts in Oregon. I've also submitted to you a copy of a news article from the state of Michigan concerning a bill of unwarranted retention of security deposits where the landlord must sue in court to retain the security deposit. That bill was passed approximately 2 weeks ago, and I do not have a copy of it. As to the economic effect of Senate Bill 159, I'm not an expert in economics. I can only re-refer you to the testimony of Professor Andrew Allentuck's economic analysis. And he is a professor at Findlay College in Ohio. He has worked with the governments of Manitoba, Michigan, and is presently working in Ohio with the legislature on landlord-tenant reform. I only had one copy of that to submit today, Mr. Chairman, and I did send that up to you. He has not found, nor does he foresee, an adverse effect on the housing market. Lastly, I refer you to the case of Lindsay versus Norme, which is a United States Supreme Court case on landlord-tenant law out of the state of Oregon. Out of the Supreme Court, it was a 5-2 decision. Two justices thought that the forcible entry and detainer statute was unconstitutional. That is a part of what this bill proposes to amend. The entire court agreed that Oregon Revised Statute 105.160 is unconstitutional. I believe that's still on the books the way it reads because it requires tenants to post a double bond when a landlord brings a forcible entry and detainer suit. The majority of the Supreme Court states that the Oregon statute, although most of it is constitutional, it is possible for these provisions to be applied so as to deprive a tenant of a proper hearing in specific situations. In other words, the law is not unconstitutional on its face, but it possibly could be, depending on the circumstances and the way it was applied. The court also suggests that absent constitutional mandate, the assurance of adequate housing and definition of landlord-tenant relationships are legislative, not judicial defunctions. And I agree with the court there, and I think that's why we're here this morning. Senate Bill 159 amends the Oregon FED statute so as to make both the tenant's promises and the landlord's promises dependent on each other. And I believe that is a welcome reform under the law. And in fact, these Supreme Court cases from other states are doing exactly that by implying a warranty of habitability. They're making dependent promises between the landlord and the tenant. That's about all I have. I do speak in support of the bill, and I'm willing to answer any questions. Please don't ask me anything on economics, because I'm not an expert.
Well, thank you for your helpful testimony. Any questions that went through? Thank you very much for this gentleman over here. You're from Eugene?
Yes, sir.
Your name is?
My name is Walter Harrison. My address is 2358-3 Patterson Drive, Eugene. I live in an apartment complex that consists approximately of 250 units. This complex is known as the Amazon Housing Project. It is run by the University of Oregon. The members of the Amazon Housing Project have formed a tenants organization called Amazon Cooperating Tenants, an acronym for which is ACT. ACT represents, as of last count, approximately 98% of the tenants in Amazon. The ACT Steering Committee, which is an elected body of the members of ACT, has asked me to speak for them this morning. I just first like to relate one incident that has happened at Amazon in the not-too-distant past. The buildings in the complex are mounted on pillar-like concrete abutments. Last summer, the university decided to undertake a study to determine if there was any dry rot present in the foundations of the buildings, as in one of the buildings a floor had fallen through. In order to do this, the university removed the lowest 2 or 3 feet of siding from the buildings, or from a majority of the buildings, and also removed whatever insulation there was. And therefore, the floors had nothing between them and raw ground except two or three feet of air. The university left the buildings in this condition until late fall. On October 31st, a group of tenants met with a representative of the university and asked that the siding be put back up, as the weather was getting cold, the floors were getting cold. We were told that the study for which the siding was removed hadn't been done yet, even though it had all been started in the summer. And meanwhile, the temperatures were getting lower, and our floors became so cold it was quite uncomfortable to stand on them in your bare feet. Finally, in late November, the landlord at the university had tar paper put up along where the siding had been removed to cover it up and to keep cold air from getting in under the buildings. Unfortunately, they did not provide any insulation because they are planning to come back next summer and take all the tar paper off again and put insulation in, and I hope put siding back on, and of course put this in the account and hopefully raise our rent because of it. In the cold weather of early December, much of this tar paper, at least on the building I lived in, cracked. It just kind of gave in, and there's holes in it and things like that, and so it became more or less useless. And our floors are still quite cold most of the time. Our heating bills are running around $7 a month higher than in previous years, according to people who have lived in the complex in previous years. In addition to causing discomfort, there's been a danger created by having these open spaces the way they are now underneath the building. Small children can crawl under there, get lost or whatnot. In addition, the cold floors cause a risk of illness to small children, as there are many in the project who have small children who of necessity crawl around a lot on cold floors. My own infant son became quite ill in November. And my wife, who is a registered nurse, attributes his illness largely to the fact that he was sitting on cold floors a lot. I support Senate Bill 159. However, the reason ACT asked me to speak, among other things, is that it appears that if this bill is enacted, it may not cover housing complexes such as Amazon. I refer you, gentlemen, to page 2 of the bill, section 8, exclusions from the ACT, line 17. Line 16 begins, residents at an institution, public or private, of incidental to detention or provision of medical, geriatric, educational, counseling, religious, or similar service. I would propose an amendment to remove the word educational from there so that housing facilities provided by educational institutions would be covered by the Act. I myself and others who I've spoken to are unsure whether housing provided by institutions of higher education would be covered by the Act, because indeed our housing is not at the institution. It is about a mile from it, and also clearly for those who live in the project who are not going to school there, such as my wife and the wives or husbands of many of the students, the housing there is not incidental to their education. Nevertheless, to avoid any ambiguities, we would hope that the word educational would be removed from section 2, from line 17. That's the only statement I have in regards to ACT. Just listening to all the comments that have been made this morning, I too have studied this bill quite thoroughly, and I would just like to add the general comment that I haven't heard aired yet this morning. this act, as many have said, would sort of even up the score between landlords and tenants, hopefully. I'm sure you next week when you hold hearings for opponents of the bill to come in, you are going to hear cries of woe concerning giving tenants these rights for self-help under Sections 29 and 30, retaliatory conduct under Section 43, security deposits under Section 18, and defenses to forcible entry and wrongful detainer actions under Section 31. I'd like to point out that tenants would be able to avail themselves of these sections only in the cases where landlords have not fulfilled their obligations to them. And I also believe that probably some landlords will say yes, but this gives the opportunity for tenants who are not acting in good faith to come in and claim that we're doing all these bad things when we're not. I fear that, I ask you the question, would you want to eliminate legislation like this in fear of bad tenants when you are thereby depriving the rights to the good tenant? I would ask you to also note that Section 11 of the Act does provide an obligation of good faith on all parties. That's the end of my testimony.
Thank you very much. The question, Senator Murdoch? Me here.
Are you an attorney?
No, sir. I am a law student.
What I want to know is, did the university blame all those horrible conditions on the legislature?
I do not know on whom the university blamed all the deplorable conditions that exist in Amazon. Are you speaking about the dry rot conditions specifically?
I thought they'd say that was the Ways and Means Committee.
Not to the best of my knowledge. What happened was that because...
If you said yes, we would have passed the bill out.
I'm just ignorant on that.
Well, I went to law school once, too.
During your discussion of the exemptions,
yes, sir.
On Section 8, page 2, did you give any thought to repealing all the exemptions? Seems to me that if you can make a case for exempting or not exempting educational, that it seemed to me that perhaps provisions for those who reside in rental areas for medical reasons are more entitled to protection of this bill than all geriatric and elderly people. And you, in this area, run on down to the list of dandy little exemptions, and they seem to just, for instance, I realize the White House in Oregon is no more, but for any place should have a landlord and tenant responsibility, that would have been the White House in Oregon.
I personally am not opposed to removing all the exemptions. I only spoke to the educational exemption in that the members of the Act Steering Committee felt that this specific exemption that was included in the Act might, you know, be bad for Act, but Amazon Cooperative Intendant.
Out of curiosity, how much rent do you pay for how large you load?
I pay $42.50 a month rent, and the reason I pay that rent is that the university is required to justify its rent that it collects from how much it spends on the project. Last year, it was shown in a hearing before the State Board on Higher Education that in the previous year, the university had made $10,000 on the project in profit. When the university requested a $10 a month rent increase. ACT fought it. University subsequently reduced its request to $2.50. ACT, the Amazon Cooperative Intendants, again fought it. There was a contested case hearing before the State Board of Higher Education in which it came out that the university claimed they had a $30,000 loss on the project. The loss was shown to be largely because there were paper losses because the university was deducting too much money from its account for maintenance that it hadn't done and therefore had in fact made a $10,000 on the project the year before, and therefore the rents were proportionate to the amount that it cost the university to run the project.
How large is your unit?
My unit consists of I'd say it's about 25 foot square. It's almost square, divided into four main rooms, two bedrooms, a living room, and a kitchen area.
All right, no further questions? Thank you very much. This gentleman back here, I've got to go. I gather you're going to speak on something other than university housing.
I'm Harold Bolkin. and I live at 5876 S Street, Springfield, Oregon. I'm a former rancher farmer, still interested over tire bonds, but live in town because we have our younger daughter with us going to school yet.
Are you speaking in favor of the bill?
Favor of the bill. I have, I think I'll have to relate my experience, having never rented at any other time. We sold our property up in McKenzie, moved into town, and made an agreement with this man on a new duplex that was just being finished on a monthly basis for $150 rent. And the first rental situation I had ever had, so he required then that I pay $150 for the month we were to move in, plus $150 for the last month, plus $50 towards the damage cleaning deposit. And on November 17th, after living there 5 months, I called the owner of the duplex and informed him that I had found a 3-bedroom home to rent and would be moving out on the December the 18th, which was the termination of each month. I had already mailed him the last payment November 14th. So in the conversation, I asked him possibly I should not have done this. And he said, no, that's according to the proper procedures. You pay the last month, and then I return your deposit of $150 and the $50 deposit cleaning if everything is okay.
I don't think all the committee can hear you, Mr. Volkman. Speak up a little bit louder.
He said this was very much according to the way it should be done, that I should pay the last month and then he would return my deposit of $200, which I had at the time I moved out. So after cleaning the duplex thoroughly, we moved out on the 18th of December, but I called the owner and informed him of this and asked him then that he would come out and inspect the residence. And I also asked him if I should turn off the water and the electricity because it was during that freezing period in December. And he said, just leave it as it is and I will take care of this. And he said, leave the keys in the duplex because I have another key so I can get in when I come to inspect it. And after several ineffective phone calls to our landlord, an entire month passed and he had not been there to inspect the premises, nor had he made any effort to return $200. And when we called and asked him about this, he told us that he would return the money anytime he felt like it. I asked him, would it be a month or a week or a year? And he says, that's your problem. In addition, we received a bill for the time then, about 2 more weeks, that the water and lights were left there. Lights were not used, but the heat was on, which he had requested we should do, which I paid when the bill came due at the end of the month. Then we went and filed a small claims in small claims court, and on request of the landlord, he requested a jury trial. We then consulted a lawyer, and after corresponding with our landlord, and we also attacked on to the district court hearing that we proposed we would have to go to, that we were also stipulating that we would ask $1,000 for intent to defraud. We immediately, the same day, he sent the $150. But he retained the $50 deposit. So the lawyer again sent him a letter and said that it would be agreeable, having talked to us, that possibly we shouldn't pursue it any further if he sent the $50. So he sent the $50. So consequently, I am out $75 attorney fee to seek by $200, which I should rightfully have had if he had inspected the building, at least $150. Therefore, I am in support and urge you to support the bill of the Uniform Residential Landlord-Tenant Act. Now, I'd have previously today been mentioned, the money that is paid on deposit. Say, for instance, that a landlord has several rentals. Should he have 10, he would have in the neighborhood of $2,000 that he can play with without interest. The tenant might stay there a year, he may stay longer. His money is laying there without any interest or anything else, not usable, and yet he has to go to law to collect from a man like this. I don't know if there's anything can be done about this particular situation. We were informed at small claims court that don't expect to collect this here because he'll pull you into district court. He does this and surprisingly wins most of his cases. And then up in investigation we found out that these tenants that most of the time drop out for fear they may lose the case and have doubled their loss. And he plays against this then up till the time that you're called into court and pays the $200, he's nothing out. But he's used your money all this time. Is there anything we can do in there to clarify this so this money could either be put in there? In a trust fund to draw interest or anything so that there'd be some clarification that a man wouldn't have. He forced me to go to court, you see, and spend $75 because he would not settle in small claims court.
We're going to be considering some amendments on that line. Any questions? Thank you very much, Mr.
Uh-huh. Thank you. I have my letter here if you want.
Fine, okay. Appreciate it. Bobby Gary, the Consumer Protection League in Portland, is that correct?
Yeah.
And one of them here now.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Bobby Gary, and I live at 2642 Southeast Tibbetts, and I'm here representing the Oregon State CPL Portland Chapter, and I'm appearing here for the bill, Senate Bill 159. I feel that the bill is a good bill that is fair to both sides, the landlord and the tenant. And the CPL committee recommends that the committee investigate the possibilities for an amendment to Senate Bill 159 that will provide for the security deposit. We've heard a lot of talk about this security deposit just now. When the security deposit is paid, sometimes when a person moves out, the landlord doesn't have it, so we would ask that some provision be made that this security deposit would be put in escrow so that the landlord would have the money to pay at the time. Now, the landlord sometimes with a good intention would pay this back, but he doesn't have. So if this money were put in escrow, then there would be no chance of it being spent. Many of the people that I represent, I'm here as a tenant, also as the representative of single people, middle age, and people on welfare. And the case that you're talking about here, that was the Lindsay case here in Oregon, was a case, one of the families that I have on my caseload, and I brought to the attention of my job, the extension service, and it was brought before legal aid and did get to the Supreme Court. So it didn't come out so good. This is
I'm Denise Johnson. I live at Route 2, Molal, Oregon, and I represent the Oregon State Committee for Progress Through Law. I am speaking in favor of the Senate Bill 159. The Senate bill appears to be fair to both landlords and tenants and requires that the landlords keep their units in safe and decent sanitary condition, which will keep the units in better shape and will keep more rental units available for people who cannot afford to buy. And it requires that the tenant keep the dwelling unit in a fit condition. Section 18 covers security deposits and prepaid rent. It requires that the landlord provide the tenant an itemized written notice of any and all damages together with the amount due within 14 days after termination of tenancy. It is recommended by the Oregon State CPL that your committee investigate the possibility of including an amendment which would require all security deposits to be put into an escrow account by the landlord and not to be used by the landlord for the operation of his business. We feel that this would help the tenant get his security deposit back and would be fair to both the tenant and the landlord. And I have several copies of this here if you would care to have them.
Thank you very much, Ms. Johnson. Any questions?
I'd also like to say that the state CPL legislative committee also has a bill, and I think it's House Bill 2542, and it is also a landlord-tenant bill. And we think that 159 and 2542 are both good bills, and if some of the amendments that we've been hearing about could come from 2542, House Bill 2542, which was written by
Representative McCoy.
Yes.